I have a hard time thinking we're really persecuted because people said mean things to us on Twitter. I don't have Twitter. Perhaps it frees me from feeling the tension of being persecuted with people saying mean things, but it just doesn't feel like a persecution. My name is Jason Craig. Welcome back to the Till and Keep podcast, where we talk a lot about the economics and the reality of home life, the intersection of all those things like work, leisure, productivity, consumption, materials, technology. But of course, all podcasts, or a lot of them, claim to be talking about the intersection of these things. We're really drilling down very often with the father, his role in ordering the family, and how very often, we talk about whether or not politics are downstream of culture, or culture downstream of politics, or technology downstream of this or that. The reality is that the father is downstream of all of it. Do we still have Thomas? You're still there. Okay. And the father has a particular role of leading the family. And a lot of times we think about that only in the form of sort of emotional support, or even just financial funding, not in the sense of he's really ordering, or that his something like his work or his view and reality of economics actually shapes the culture of the home. We tend to think of him as a lawgiver, and sometimes a negative sense, instead of law in the classical sense, meaning, you know, bringing order to something, not just limiting the freedom of something, but ordering something that's good. And that's his job. So today, I'm really excited to have with us Thomas Stork, who there's a number of books that I've read or excerpts, and he's kind of contributed in lots of places when it comes to this very idea of economics. He recently had a book called The Prosperity Gospel, which I read. It was wonderful. It sort of begins in some of the economic realities of things and ends in everything from artwork and how we view culture, and it's really great. But the reason, Thomas, I'd like to have you on is my experience conservative American male father space, it seems that there's a lot of really identifiable sins and vices and disorders that are fun to laugh at. Everything from transgenderism and other wokenesses that are really easy to recognize as errors or deadly or poisonous. In fact, they're laughably so. They're almost not perhaps as threatening as we think they are, or we'll complain about I have a hard time thinking we're really persecuted because people said mean things to us on Twitter. I don't have Twitter. Perhaps it frees me from feeling the tension of being persecuted with people saying mean things, but it just doesn't feel like a persecution. So there's lots of little things that we can point at, but I would say when I'm talking to fathers and we get to the brass tacks of certain things, one of our sacred cows that we're not really willing to slaughter is actually in the world of money and how we think about money and success. And I think there's a particularly underlying, whether we like it or not, American thread in our even Calvinist backgrounds. And whereas, you know, God is the reason we're rich as a country or as people is because God has blessed us for our good actions, in our goodwill. And that's why we have stuff. And I don't know how we would think about the Holy Family or, you know, other impoverished saints, but they, you know, they, something they didn't have that we now have that God has rewarded. So that's what I wanted to ask you about today. So how did you get into it? It seems as if you've written quite extensively on this, your book, From Christendom to Americanism and Beyond, this book, The Prosperity Gospel. How did you sort of fall into this line of study and thought when it comes to how we think about money and God's reward and how to live life?
Well, it started back when I was in high school, actually, a long, long time ago. Even though my family was church going, I wasn't really raised as a Christian or expected to be a Christian. So during high school, I first came to believe in God and then moved toward being a Christian and then some years later, 10 years later, a Catholic. But I read at that time Richard Tolney's very famous book, Religion and the Rise of Capitalism, which talked about medieval economic morality, how the church had a very robust doctrine of economic morality during the Middle Ages. And I thought, gee, this accords with some of the things that I'm hearing around me from surprising voices that aren't necessarily Protestants or Catholics. And so I started studying more, and then eventually I discovered the papal social encyclicals and the immense secondary works that talk about them. And that's been one of my compelling interests since then. And it goes along with the idea of another interest of mine is of a Catholic culture. Anyway, a Catholic culture is going to be more than just having beautiful churches and processions, important as those are. It's going to mean that Catholicism permeates every aspect of our life, our economics, our art, our politics, our family life, you name it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Catholics in the United States have not realized the necessity for the faith to live itself out as a cultural thing, not in the sense of, sometimes people use the word cultural Catholics to mean somebody who's, oh yeah, I'm a Catholic because I'm Italian or whatever. That's not what I mean by cultural Catholic. I mean a Catholic whose faith permeates not just their individual life, but their family life, and insofar as possible, their whole social life, their whole civic life, which is what we should be aiming for.
Yeah, that's it's interesting. I'm a convert as well. I think we probably share similar interests in, you know, Christopher Dawson or, you know, these students of Catholic culture as it was. And, you know, I see these websites and things that like, we're going to restore Christendom. And the more I learn about Christendom and how they thought about things, the more we don't deserve Christendom. I mean, they really gave serious thought, not just on, processions and churches, which they did, but how does the gospel actually affect like interest rates and loan and business and profits and families and arrangements? And and whether or not you think they were efficient or good, maybe there's some debate there, or you could, but you cannot say that God wasn't the center of what they were doing. And for us, we don't deserve it, because when we say things like we're going to restore Christendom on our websites, something about that seems sad and laughable to me. And that I realize, I think when we think of culture as Americans, we actually think of branding, that we're kind of branding ourselves with the bumper stickers and the accoutrements of what it looks like. We're sharing the correct memes. We've got the t-shirts, we've got the bumper stickers, we're going to mass, and we're listening to the right podcasts, and Till and Keep, of course. We're watching the right YouTube channels. We're sharing all that. It's sort of branding and positioning, whereas it actually doesn't really affect the order. It just affects how we consume things and what we're wearing and putting on. Like, it just kind of right. Like buying things.
You know, you will probably recall the late Cardinal George about 25 years ago said that American Catholics were cultural Calvinists. Yeah. And that was a very insightful comment of his. And when the huge Catholic immigration in the 19th and early 20th century came, they came to a country that was already a bastion of Protestantism, kind of Protestant in its mores, its institutions, its ways of thinking, its educational system. And most Catholic, the church was fighting just to hold her own, just to preserve her members from drifting away from the faith, which was not always that successful in the 19th century. And it was difficult for Catholics at the time to undertake the gigantic project, which they didn't really fully realize, or maybe realize much at all, that it needed to be done, the gigantic project of converting the culture as such. And then you had various people like, say, Archbishop Ireland of St. Paul or Cardinal Gibbons, who were actually opposed to the idea of doing that. They welcomed Americanism. They wanted Catholics to conform as much as possible to the Protestant mores, where that didn't explicitly violate some tenet of the faith. Mm-hmm. And they didn't understand that the faith was more than just what you read in the Baltimore Catechism, important and vital as that is. It shapes our whole way of life. So speaking of Catholics, we've always had this tendency to conform to the Protestant milieu that surrounds us. And this has especially gotten worse since the 1960s, since the council, where discipline in the church has pretty much broken down. And if Catholics are looking for some kind of a cultural identity in the United States, they don't even realize that there is a Catholic cultural identity waiting for them if they would only know where to look for it. So where do they look instead? They look at one of the two political cultural blocks that America is basically divided into, which we call conservative and liberal. Those names are problematic enough, but I'll use them because that's what everybody does, and it would be stupid to kind of to try not to. So we have the conservative block, which is, as far as economic teachings, is actually just a kind of a leftover form of 19th century liberalism. Because liberalism, which has been a slow revolt against Christendom since the 16th century, changes its teachings, as it were. It's changing its views every 150 years, whatever. So, for example, in the early 19th century, liberals were at the forefront of the free market. They wanted to free people from the restrictions that the guilds and the Catholic monarchs had imposed upon people. Was supposed to be dynamic in the economy, people like Adam Smith, David Ricardo. And so liberalism in the early 19th century was very much in favor of the free market. About 100 years later, liberalism began to change and now saw that the free market needed restrictions. And liberalism, say on free speech, liberalism used to be very absolutist on free speech. Now the more advanced liberals are openly advocating restrictions on speech that they don't like. So liberalism is a very protean movement. It doesn't really have any principles except wanting to throw off shackles, whatever shackles seems to be fascinated at the moment and wants to get rid of. But the problem is that the conservatives in the United States have latched on to a 19th century form of liberalism, which includes, as I said, a very robust defense of free markets. And those Catholics who identify as conservatives, most of them don't know much about the Catholic papal social teaching. And those who do will sometimes actually reject it because for them, this conservative, really 19th century liberal, but conservative worldview trumps their Catholic worldview, at least when it comes to socioeconomic things. And that's why I think I have written before in the past, it is so vital, but no one seems to agree with me on this. It is so vital to jettison these terms and say, what do you think about things? Well, not to say I'm a conservative. No, I'm a Catholic. And my views on things flow as far as I can determine them, as far as I can make them. They flow from the central teachings of the Catholic faith. And they whether that be on the family, on issues of life, on issues of money, on issues of foreign policy, whatever, I ought to make my views consonant with the church's teaching.
Right. I'm not sure if you had it in this book, but it does seem that our terms, conservative and liberal, as we use them in this country, they're just two sides of the same coin, which is liberalism. They're just different forms because they actually don't take as much as all the rhetoric comes out. They don't take things like God and the family is actually the center of our life. And this comes out all the time. The example I use, because a lot of people have read some of the Little House books, The Little House on the Prairie, and then there's one, The Long Winter, I think it's called, something like that. And Almanzo, who's one of the main characters that's in one of the other books, and he marries Laura Ingalls, Almanzo finds out that there's a farmer who has a storehouse of grain out, and he's out and they're going to go talk to him about buying it. And when he gets there, and it's this heroic journey through this, like, just blistering cold, and everyone's dying in the village. They're starving to death because there's no food. His blizzard has just bucked. And he gets there and they're having this discussion as two liberals. I mean, we think of the culture that they had as being, and there are things about it that are conservative and good and family centric and hard work. Like there's obviously good in there. We would be repulsed by it, but the place where it's sort of, they don't see their own is when he's trying to persuade this guy to sell the grain, which he has an excess of, sell it, not even give it, sell it to the village that's starving to death. He won't, because they didn't plan well enough. And then Almanzo, who's come to get this grain, is like, he basically is like, I see your point. And in this instance where the care of one's neighbor would obviously necessarily, so Aquinas would teach in that moment that actually those goods become, and we're scared to say these things. I mean, people love to talk about Aquinas and traditional teaching and all that until it actually matters. Because Aquinas would say in those instances when in extreme necessity that those goods actually become common, because that's how God intended it. God intended.
Yeah, they would have a right to take it if the owner refused to sell it to them.
Because, but we actually have a hard time as conservative American men. We actually have a hard time with that. A really hard time, because I mean, I can feel it. I'm knowing the truth. I'm trying to have a conversion here in my gut of sight. Well, it's his. It's his. I mean, what are you going to do? Take it? What are you going to do? Redistribute it? Is that who you know? I just use this as an example, because often, even conservatives, they don't have arguments against things like pornography. If the free market, if people want it, they can have it. I mean, there's a lot of ways that they're not willing to think about law as bringing right order to society, like the church would teach. And they only think of it in terms of we need less. So we think of law as imposing a restriction on the individual. And we don't think of law as the way a father, when a father makes a rule in a house, he's not limiting freedom. He's bringing order to the house. We have a hard time thinking about law in that way, because we've been conditioned to just, and now I'm happy to have that impulse. A lot of times I'm happy to have fought back in some of the madness during COVID. And there's times where that helps us. But there's some underlying assumptions that aren't just sort of, rugged in the good way, but just rugged in an ultimately evil way.
Yeah, this actually goes back to the philosophy of John Locke, and I've mentioned that in the book you mentioned, From Christendom to Americanism. I talk about Locke, and in other places I've talked about Locke. Locke was an English philosopher who died in I think 1704, very early in the 18th century, and he posited that the people, individual human beings, individual men, were by nature separate. Our natural state is a state of nature. And when we come into society and into a political order, we're limiting our freedom. We're limiting something that's actually natural to us in exchange for obvious goods like protection and cooperation and that kind of thing. But this Lockean view has been is deeply ingrained in the American psyche. And it's wrong, because we're not, as you said about the family, we're not limiting ourselves by coming into a political community. Aquinas is quite clear, the natural state of man is to live in a community, following Aristotle, he said this. And it's not a limitation on our freedom. It's a guidance of our freedom and a fulfillment of our nature. Now, this Lockean view has colored our attitude toward government. So, the government wants to do a thing, it must be bad. It must be a limitation of freedom. Then they'll screw it up. Sometimes government does screw things up, but people screw things up all the time. But John Locke is really the central thinker here who has an amazing influence on somebody called the historian Lewis Hart, so that Locke was a national cliche in the United States. His thinking is just taken for granted. And the purpose of government is to secure our rights. Well, no, not really. The purpose of government is to bring us to virtue and ultimately to heaven. Not that the government does it directly the way the church does, but the government sets the framework, as it were, in which we can live virtuous lives. And right.
I think a helpful way is that there are times where, in fact, so It's like the government is there. It's doing something. Now, there are times we wish it was doing less or something different, but it's active. And the way that we understand it and it understands us, right? Are we radical individuals? Or, I mean, because this is a huge tussle right now in the culture wars. Is America made up of families, right? Or is America made up of just radical individuals? And for some, the family itself is a hindrance to
personal. Yeah, you know, the family is the basic unit. It's prior to the state. But the political community, the state is the natural home of mankind. And the remedy for bad government is good government, not no government. Right. It's like a remedy for an abusive father is not remove the father, but convert the father.
Right. In Joseph Pierce's book, Small is Still Beautiful, which is the play on the Schumacher, Small is Beautiful.
Yeah.
He traces, and because the government is doing something, and it's, like you said, it's not whether it's there or not, it's whether it's good or bad. And the example he uses is breweries, that because of government, well, first of all, because of the use of government to outlaw alcohol, prohibition, it stifled, you know, a lot of breweries naturally shut down. Only a few survived. And on the other side of it, they had a bit of a monopoly. It actually took people reordering, not just retracting government altogether, but actually reordering things like regulation and actually making the market truly free. Whereas there's some amongst us that would have just defended, well, the reason Anheuser-Busch or whatever, the reason they're huge is because they're better. Which was absolutely not true, and it was the government, the laws on the books, along with the sheer power and the force of these giant breweries that stopped. And now we have this. I live in Western North Carolina, so you know there's a new brewery every week here, and it's thanks to a proper ordering of the laws around the production of beer and alcohol that have allowed this to happen. So it's not just less laws, although you know that can be removing onerous or unjust laws is like no one's arguing for that. But we have a hard time saying, no, the government does need to do something to make things better.
Yeah, well, every law has a worldview behind it. You know, the most minimalist law, the most maximalist law, every law has a worldview behind it and forces some vision of right and wrong. And but as far as the free market is concerned, we've got to be careful not to regard that as the gold standard, because as Pius XI says in Grandis Loano, the free market, the concept that free competition should be the ruling principle in the economy is false. He says he compares it to a polluted spring that's polluted our thinking. So that it doesn't necessarily, this is one of the problems we have today, is that people say, "Oh, so you want the government to control everything?" No. The medieval Christendom order that we were talking about earlier, that thought long and hard about how to make social life Christian, they realized that there were intermediate groups, like, for example, guilds, that were the chief ones, and they played a tremendous role in regulating the economy for the common good. They weren't directly controlled by the central government. They were private associations with public responsibilities, and this is really a quintessentially Catholic approach to it. It's a brilliant solution, actually, of the problem of economic regulation, not by the central state, even less by the individual, because there you have economic power, and so you have these intermediate groups that are able to do a lot of the economic regulation.
Yeah, I'm fascinated with how often rerum novarum comes up in discussions of social order, and then Pius XI and his encyclical and the commemoration of it. But people rarely talk about, you know, they get into socialism, capitalism, individual, state, communism, all of these discussions, and everyone seems to forget how rerum novarum ends, which it's pretty practical. What he calls for, as far, you know, he goes through all these social ills that will come from the state being in control of everything or just absolute free market, you know, capital being in charge of everything. He goes through all the disorders. And his recommendation is the family and these intermediary bodies of the guilds, that if the family as its own household within itself, as the church teaches, is incomplete, right? Meaning the family is an imperfect society. And that doesn't have to do with the levels of perfection. It has to do with, it does not have everything it needs to be itself. And the way we know that is my daughter, my oldest daughter, if she becomes married, if she grows up, she can't marry anyone in the family, right? We have needs outside of the family. The family needs other families. And that's our first step into politics and government. And the church from Rerum Novarum to now, is proposing that it's not the power sharing between the individual, business, or government. Those are like our only metrics. It's the family and then the local intermediary bodies that had the equivalent in Christendom, in the guilds, which had real and actual power. Even with the church, had huge influence with even with clergy and religious orders, and the laymen bemoan not having any power, but they're not really uniting. And I actually think we're limited in uniting ourselves because the guilds, and I can't remember the author of this book, but it really woke me up to it. The Art of Solidarity in the Middle Ages was the name of it. And he just shows how the guilds were willing to need and depend and rely and be accountable to one another in ways that were binding. They were binding like a family.
And the fundamental principle there, which is really the fundamental principle of Catholic thinking about economics, is that the economy has a purpose. It's not just there. And for you to use it the way you want, for me to use it the way I want, and maybe I want to get rich and you want to help the poor. So, okay, fine, they're equivalent. It's your personal will. No, the economy has a purpose to supply us with the external goods we need and services so that we can spend our life on what's more important, the family, intellectual life, spiritual life, ultimately getting to heaven. And so when you have an end, a purpose, I'm sure you're familiar with the principle that the purpose determines everything. As Aristotle said, you decide on your purpose first, and that determines everything else. In the end, if I want to get to the next town, then I know I have to go in that direction. I can't just head in the opposite direction. The purpose of where I'm going is what determines all the features of my journey. And similarly with the economy, if we know what the economy exists for, then we can say, okay, these are the features it ought to have. It ought to foster the family, not destroy the family by pulling people in different ways and making people work too much and having people work on Sunday and so on and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say? The only question I thought, it seems that the medievals and their guilds, that they actually saw the sanctification of their economy less severed from the spiritual reality. They saw these things, and obviously we can sanctify, but they had less, just breathing in and out. The old Ora et Labora was just breathing in and out of the same life. This conversation can seem quite easily, and it's esoteric, meaning how do we ground this? I don't want easy ways to make, to bring back Christendom or anything like that. But when it comes to the economics of the home, and also I think I'd like to ask you about the blind spot where the way that we think about money, because we're talking about how to ground this at home. This might sound like, oh, this is all just a lot of talk about power sharing and money, all this. It doesn't really affect me, but it actually does, because when we wake up, why we're working, and why we think we need more money or why we're stressing about not having enough of it, is affected by what the purpose, what we think our money's for. And you bring up in this book that we tend to, in the book, The Prosperity Gospel, that we think of money as a reward. Is that part of the Calvinist thinking? And then my follow-up question, so explain that to me. And then also how does this affect your average dad? If you've given that kind of some of that thought, how do these economic realities and the way Americans view this, how is this affecting us in our home life?
Well, we don't, if money, of course, is just a surrogate, as it were, for external goods. Money in itself, I can't eat it, I can't wear it, it doesn't keep me warm. I guess I could burn a lot of currency, keep myself warm for a little while. But it's a surrogate for external goods. So the real question is, what is the purpose of external goods? And God does expect us to use external goods. He made us in such a way that we need them. And human cultural life is made better by certain external goods. But there's a limit on that. It's not just, I want as much as I want because I want it. So for example, house size in the United States, as in average house size, has increased since around 1970, while average family size has fallen. That makes absolutely no sense at all. Let's take a husband and wife. Well, how big a house do they really need? Some people need a big house. They might have businesses at home and that kind of thing. But there is a limit as to what is reasonable to have as a house size. And if your house is gigantic, you might want to ask yourself, why do I want this house? Is it to impress the neighbors? Is it to impress my family or whatever? But it's really irrational. It's like having a pair of shoes twice the size you need because I can afford a big pair of shoes. Or my shirt are twice the size I need. It just makes no sense at all. So we have to put goods, material goods, in their place as servants of human life, not as masters, not as goals, but simply as means to an end. And the end is what counts, not the means to the end. And, there's a lot of things that can be done, depending on, but circumstances differ so much. There's a lot of things that can be done. For example, in families where the husband is fortunate enough to be able to earn a living wage, and so his wife can stay at home and take care of the children, then she can do a lot in terms of genuine cooking instead of getting fast food stuff all the time. And even maybe gardening and growing some of their own food. And the children, that's something the children can help out in. It's all those kinds of things. But again, it depends on the right order. If a husband can't make enough money, if he can't make a living wage, then that destroys the part of the integrity of the family. So it's, you see here how the economy is directly linked to family life. So one of the biggest frauds perpetrated on the American people was in the early 80s when the corporations took advantage of the feminists and said, yeah, women want to work outside the home. And what it enabled to do, it destroyed family life and it enabled corporations to lower wages because now they could get a family, they could get two people working for the price of one or a little bit over one, say. So right. It was a real fraud that they perpetrated on the public.
Yeah, it's interesting how the defense of unions now is how different they were from the Catholic the unions and that the church supported early on for the working wage of the father would never have supported encouraging or bringing in the wives to essentially compete for wages with their own husbands for the maintenance of the same family, because everyone loses except the corporation in that case, because the husband makes less, the wife makes less, the family is no longer cohesive because no one's at home and the children are, and then we've realized the Marxist dream of now that the only thing to do with the children is to hand them over to the state. The only one benefiting is the corporation itself.
Exactly. But one of the first things we can do to order our thinking correctly, and maybe if we abandon calling ourselves conservatives and started calling ourselves, well, I'm just Catholic, that would be a first step. Because really, what you should ask somebody, if you're a conservative, what do you want to conserve? Yeah, and if you say, well, Catholicism, well, then why don't you call yourself a Catholic? Just like progressives, you had, well, what do you want to progress? What are you trying to progress toward? And most of them would not know what to say.
Right.
But
they would say God. Right.
Some of the, I think in the late, in the 50s, Frank Meyer, who was one of the fusionist conservatives, conservatism is trying to conserve freedom. Well, I think a lot of people would agree with that, but it's wrong, because freedom is not the highest political good. Justice is. And freedom is a good in its place, sure, but in and of itself is a means to an end.
And I don't, I just, that doesn't hold water. The moment we start again thinking of the family as the center, any parent, any half decent parent knows that if the family is, you know, our goal really is the health of the family, there's nothing more limiting to my freedom than my family. My freedom is everything good in my life, from my marriage to my children to my milk cows. Everything that I enjoy and I love is a limitation to my freedom. So I can't, of course, I would like us to be, I would like to be able to be free to be a husband, to be a father, to milk my cows, to enjoy what, you know, talking and thinking with my own friends. And of course that's, but when we just say freedom in the abstract, we can do, you know, we can do whatever we want. We just call it freedom and we can do whatever we want.
That's the freedom of Satan, who is unwilling to submit to his created position as a pretty high ranking angel, because he wanted what? He wanted disordered freedom. He wanted to be able to do whatever he wanted.
Right. And that's the, I do, I think it's in the background here, not the Liturgy of the Land book. There it is. My friend Tommy and I, that's what we did. About 12 years ago, we started homesteading and we just wrote this book together. Because, and the thing that we laugh about is when people accuse us, they romanticize what we're trying to do out in the country and milking our cows, and he raises bees, and they think of us as sort of like radical pioneer, freedom spirited, which in some ways is true, but there's nothing less freeing than having a homestead. It grounds us, but the reason that we do it is actually that limitation makes us truly free to just be fully human with our family, to do the work. It sort of orients it's the dominant economic reality around us, meaning because we're actually growing, we need it. We need the food. And it supplies our needs directly and it brings us all together. There's a very practical, actionable thing that people, they think, well, that's so romantic. And I laugh, I'm like, that is literally the most practical thing. That's not practical. I just cannot think of something more practical than a hog in the backyard. I don't know why that gets labeled as impractical, whereas modern banking we cannot question because that would be impractical. I don't understand the revulsion to things that are truly very practically good for our family and our economy.
Well, it's the... when you start thinking the way you have to the roots of things and reasoning back to first principles, then you're going to come up with different solutions from what most people have. And they're going to seem odd, romantic, whatever. But they're really just basing things on first principles. And, you know, if I have a family, the family needs this, I need to do that. Oh, okay.
Well, if you're fed since the fourth grade that the highest good is to save enough money to retire early, then yeah, that's sort of the end we're all pursuing.
Yeah.
So I glossed over this question because it was my fault, because I asked like four questions instead of one. Speak a little bit about the, because I come from an evangelical background and a Calvinist background. Don't worry, I've repented. The underlying thought, though, for us is that I think one of the reasons we buy big houses or enjoy big flashy lives without embarrassment, right? I mean, Catholics of a certain time would have been less ostentatious. Or if you were ostentatious, it's something I learned from Mark Barnes over at New Polity. You know, the reason that the rich had to wear certain hats is actually marked them as rich, meaning you can expect from them the duties of the rich would be like the support of the church and things like that. But ours is a little more just flamboyant, that it's actually a sign of our favor with God. Is that, just speak a little about what do you mean by that?
Well, and then when you go back to Calvinism, where God has chosen in some versions, even before the fall, and other versions after the fall, has chosen certain people to be saved and certain people to be damned. And there's nothing they can do about that. It's not a matter of their conduct or their faith even. If you're Israelite, you're like a robot, really. There's no drama in the salvation whatsoever. And so one of the ways you know that you are among the elect, among those whom God chose to save, is prosperity in the world. And even though most Americans would reject this right now, it's kind of a, we have a secularized version of it. So if I've done well economically, then that means, that must mean I've done something right. I'm smart. Something's helped me. Maybe karma, they would say now. I don't know. But in any case, you've done well. And the poor man is struggling, as in the Laura Wendell Island books you brought up a minute ago. They didn't plan well. I've actually seen somebody defending Ebenezer Scrooge in Dickens' Christmas Carols as saying, well, Bob Cratchit didn't plan well. he should have known before he got married and had children that his income was limited. And instead of any kind of solidarity between Scrooge and Cratchit, Bob Cratchit, this writer was just saying Cratchit was a loser, and too bad, but that's the way it was. And instead of looking on human society as a band of brothers, we look upon human society as a band of, a band of cats, as somebody said, fighting each other, trying to get ahead. And this is a profoundly un-Catholic view of social order. Yeah. And one that we really have to work against at every level. And Catholics who pride themselves on their orthodoxy, it's not just a matter of, I mean, I would never, ever downplay the slightest adherence to the Church's doctrinal and personal moral teachings. Those are absolutely essential. But also essential are the adherence to the Church's social teachings and the whole social milieu that the Church has fostered. Pope Pius XI, in his first encyclical, said at the end of the encyclical, he said, and this came just maybe 10, 15 years after the modernist crisis, he said, people who reject the Catholic social teaching, he called them social modernists. And he said, I reject this as vehemently as I do dogmatic modernism. Hmm. And that's a pretty firm and clear statement.
Yeah, it does. I think if we examine ourselves closely, though, even the divides in the Church, it's those that, I mean, if you kind of scratch the surface, those are the two forms of modern, just as in America, we talk about liberalism, the two sides of the coin, so-called conservatives, so-called liberals. They're both libertines, liberalism. In the Church, it very often, if you scratch the surface, depending on the circles you're in, it's either we tend towards the modernism of against the social teaching, or we're ultra-modernist with dogmatic teaching. I mean, it's like we pick one or the other, and we're divided in those places. And I find... You know, me personally, I fully assented. I find the dogmatic teaching easier. And it's something, it's right there in the script. We could argue it. It's just good old fashioned arguments. But I think in the social and the public life, because it actually affects how we treat and think about one another. For example, use the word competition. I think we're conditioned to think of one another as competitors, as God has made the world such that it is limited in whether it be honor, right, or tomatoes, right? There's a limitation, and I have to get more of it, which is opposed to the gospel, that if we die, and I think of the my sons and I were having the discussion. I'm encouraging one of them in their homeschool he's learning propagation, and I want him to see that this plant, we're taking cuttings, we're pruning the plant, and we're growing more of this plant, and by using compost and working with the natural thing, that actually the more we do, the more fruitful everything around us is becoming without depleting anything. That's actually, we don't live as if that's true. And I mean that socially. I mean, in our interactions with one another, and this is when it comes to envy and jealousy, if one person is honored and I'm forgotten, there something has been diminished from me. And this is, it's bigger than I think we're willing to think about. And it comes back down to, do we think of one another as, you use the word brothers, right? Do we think of one another as family, especially in the Church, which is how St. Paul makes explicit. We're a family. I mean, that's the overwhelming, arch word for how we belong to one another. We don't think about one another in that way.
Yeah. If you study economics, mainstream economics, you'll see that one of the, probably the most fundamental concept that they posit is scarcity. And scarcity against what? Scarcity against your own disordered desires. They never ask the question, is there enough for everyone to have a reasonable life? No, they said, it's not enough for you to have everything you want, because you want everything. You want to be the richest man in the world, and so do I. Well, we can't both be, so we got to fight.
Which that's our fundamental relationship to one another at that point is become.
Right, and that's just absurd, as you pointed out about plants. It's amazing. They just, in a sense, it's almost like creation ex nihilo over and over again.
Yeah.
Think of all the wood, for example, that grows every year. And then we take it and build houses, ships, all kinds of things out of it. And guess what? It's still coming.
It's still coming. Yeah.
I think the ability of God.
The offense against God, when we have that attitude, and again, whether we think we're conservative, we think we're liberal, if we're formed by these philosophical backdrops, when we do that, we don't realize the offense against God, that he made creation defective, that he made the order of things has a defect, and the defect is scarcity. Therefore, let's take control. Take what's ours, dominate where it's necessary. And if, you know, if every now and then we got to dispatch a few and cull the herd, you know, we might have to do that. But we actually don't believe that the world is created, whereas our actions create more abundance and fertility. In other words, we don't believe that the order of the world is love.
No, it's very true. Because since the 18th century, in the United States, we have a curious fusion since the 18th century of Calvinism and Enlightenment Lockeanism. Of all the Enlightenment philosophers, Locke is the one that's had most influence on American thinking. But it's fused itself with this Calvinism, so it's made a very peculiar kind of worldview. And as I said before, Catholics have uncritically bought into it. Many Catholics have. Even whether they call themselves liberal, conservative, orthodox, they often are just their own version of Lockeanism, of Calvinism, Calvinist Lockeanism. So you can see among liberal Catholics, for example, a hesitation to think that our sexual lives have any kind of implication for the social order. So it should be everyone can do whatever he wants. And among people who might call themselves conservative Catholics, they have difficulty seeing that their economic activity has any implications for the common good. And so let's let everyone do whatever he wants. And they're both wrong. Both the economic appetite and the sexual appetite have to be oriented toward the common good, which happens to be what their own good is too. You know, what the purpose of those two aspects of human life is.
Well, Thomas, I'm going to have to end this because you are attempting to apply Catholic social thought and limit my freedom. So if you're going to do such nonsense as that, I'm going to have to limit this podcast. And I've enjoyed it. I hope those that are listening did too. I hope it don't sound like too impractical. I think that's why it's often dismissed, but I think what you're showing, and I really appreciate it, is that actually this is the water we swim in, and we don't know it, and we don't recognize. And I think a lot of times we're boxing the air because we're hitting at enemies that are obvious to us. You know, those of us that might see the obvious dogmatic, you know, look, if somebody's denying the Immaculate Conception, like it's laughable. It's a joke, but the harder thing for us in our households and our communities is to actually see one another in these kind of ways that limit our freedom and force us to actually, you know, act like loving one another is important. I believe Jesus said something about that. So thank you so much. Where can we, do you have a regular blog or Substack? Where can we point people?
Well, I don't know.
Good.
You can find a list of all my books. I have an author page on Amazon. Not that I recommend Amazon that much, but they did it, not me. And you can find archives of my articles on some of the places I've written for online: the Distributist Review, Ethical Politica, Practical Distributism. All those would be three main places.
Great.
I have a lot of articles of mine.
All right, Thomas, Mr. Stork, thank you so much for being on Till and Keep podcast. I really
thank you for having me.
Next time, we'll talk.
This episode of Till and Keep has been brought to you by TAN, Fraternus, and Sword and Spade. Till and Keep is a podcast that shows how the primordial command from God to Adam to till and keep the garden applies whether you toil on a farm or in a concrete jungle. Visit tillandkeeppodcast.com to subscribe and follow the show. And use coupon code TILL25 to get 25% off your next order at tanbooks.com.